concerned about what was in front of me than behind. For a moment, I thought I should go back and help Uncle Press, but jumping into the middle of a blazing gun battle didn't seem like such a hot idea. I could only hope that he could handle the situation. The only thing I could do was follow his instructions. It was dark. I had to feel my way along the greasy wall to make sure I didn't accidentally step on the tracks. I'd heard about the infamous electric third rail that powered the trains. If you stepped on that thing, you were bacon. So I stayed as close to the wall as I could. Uncle Press said this door was about 30 yards down from the platform. I tried to picture a football field to visualize how far 30 yards was. It didn't help. I figured I'd just keep moving until my hand hit this mysterious door. My biggest fear was that I'd miss it, and then... a grumble came from behind me. What was that? Was it a train? Was it power surging through the third rail? It was neither, because I heard it again, and it came from a different direction. It sounded like growling. But I didn't think rats growled, so it couldn't be rats. Good thing. I hated rats. I looked around slowly, and in the dim light, I saw something that nearly made my heart stop. Across the tracks, looking straight at me, were a pair of eyes. They were low to the ground, and caught the light in such a way that it made them flash yellow. It was some kind of animal. Could this be the quig Uncle Press had told me to watch out for? Or maybe it was a wild dog. Whatever it was big. And it had friends, because more eyes appeared. It was a pack of animals gathering, and their growling told me they weren't friendly. Gulp. My plan was to do everything I could not to threaten them. I decided to move very slowly, very deliberately, and make my way toward the door and... Too late. The entire pack of dogs, or quigs, or whatever they were, leaped from the shadows and charged me. Suddenly the third rail didn't seem all that dangerous. I turned and ran. There must have been a dozen of them. I could hear their teeth gnashing and their claws scratching on the metal rails as they bounded over one another to get to me, and I didn't want to think of what would happen if they did. I remember having a fleeting thought that maybe they'd hit the third rail and vaporize, but that didn't happen. My only hope was finding that door. It was so dark I kept tripping over stones and garbage and railroad ties and everything else down there, but I kept going. I had no choice. If I fell, I was kibble. Then, like a lifeline to a drowning man, I saw it. The only light came from dirty old bulbs strung above the tracks, but it was enough for me to see. Recessed into the cement wall was a small door with a faint star shape carved into the wood. This was it. I ran up to the door, only to discover there was no door handle. I couldn't open it. I looked back and saw the pack of animals nearly on me. I only had a few more seconds. I leaned my weight against the door, and it opened. The door opened in, not out. I fell inside and quickly scrambled back to close the door just as slam, 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 the animals hit the door. I leaned back on the door, desperate to keep them out. But they were strong. I could hear their claws feverishly scratching at the wooden door. I couldn't keep them out for long. Now, I'm going to stop my story here, Mark, because what happened next was far more important than those animals who were trying to get me. I know, hard to believe, but it was. Obviously, the wild dogs, or the quigs, or whatever they're called, didn't get me. If they had, I wouldn't be writing this. Duh. I think what happened next was the single most important event of this whole nightmare. As scary and as strange as everything was that had happened up till then, there was no way I could have been prepared for what was waiting for me beyond that door. While I was trying to keep the animals out, I looked at the space I'd just entered. What I saw was a long, dark tunnel. It wasn't big, maybe about 6 feet high. The walls were made of craggy, slate-gray rock. It didn't look as if it were drilled out by a machine, either. It was crude, like somebody dug the tunnel with hand tools. I couldn't see how far the tunnel went back because it dropped off into blackness. It could have gone on forever. I didn't know what to do. If I tried to run down the tunnel, the instant I left the door, the animals would burst in and be on me. Not a good move. I was stuck. But then I remembered what Uncle Press had told me. There was a word. He'd said to go inside and say this word. He'd said it would get us to where we were going. What was that word? Denison? Dandelion? Dandruff? I couldn't really see how saying a hocus-pocus word could get me out of this predicament, but it was the only choice I had. Then I remembered it. Dinduron. It meant nothing to me, but if it was going to get me out of this, it would be my favorite word in the world. So I put my back to the door, planted my feet, looked into the dark tunnel, and shouted out, Dinduron! Instantly, the animals stopped beating against the door. It didn't sound like they ran away. They were just suddenly not there. I took a chance and stepped away from the door, and nothing happened. At least, nothing happened with the door. The tunnel was another thing altogether. It started as a hum. It was low at first, but the frequency started to grow. I looked into the tunnel and watched in wonder as the walls started to twist and move. I was looking down the barrel of a huge, flexible, living pipeline. Then the walls started to change. They went from solid gray to clear. These craggy walls suddenly looked as if they were made of crystal or diamonds. Light was everywhere, as if it were coming right from the walls themselves. It was truly an amazing sight. So amazing that I didn't stop to wonder what it all meant. That's when I heard the music. It wasn't a recognizable tune or anything. It was just a bunch of soft, sweet notes that were all jumbled up. It was almost hypnotic. The mixed-up notes got louder and louder, as if they were coming closer. The thing that brought me back to myself was a strange sensation. I stood at the mouth of the tunnel and felt a tingling throughout my body. It wasn't horrible, just strange. The tingling grew stronger, and I felt an odd but unmistakable tug. I didn't realize it at first, but it soon dawned on me that I was being pulled into the tunnel. Some giant, invisible hand had gotten hold of me and was pulling me in. I tried to back away, but the force grew stronger. Now I started to panic. I turned and tried to find something, anything to grab onto. I fell down and dug my nails into the ground, but nothing worked. I was being sucked into this horrible tunnel, and there was nothing I could do to stop it. This is the point. This is where my life changed. What happened next turned everything I had ever known, everything I had ever believed in, everything I had ever thought to be real, totally inside out. I got sucked into the rabbit hole, Mark, and I was headed for Wonderland. Second Earth. Mark had to get out of this bathroom. The little stall was closing in on him. He tried to jump up off the seat, but a loop on his pack was caught on the flusher handle, and all he managed to do was fall back and flush the stupid toilet. He pulled his pack free, jammed the parchment papers into it, then fumbled for the lock to spring himself from the stall. He was so flustered he couldn't even work the simple latch. Finally, mercifully, he slammed it back and threw the door open to see...
Standing there was Andy Mitchell. He was leaning casually against the wall, smoking a cigarette.
"Jeez, you've been in there a long time, Diamond. Everything come out all right?"
Mitchell gave a stupid grin like this was a truly clever line. Mark froze for a second, feeling as if he had been caught doing something wrong.
"I'm fine.
When Mark got nervous, he had a little stutter. It wasn't a horrible thing, just something that came out under stress. Mitchell expertly flipped his cigarette across the room, and it landed in one of the urinals. Bullseye. Ordinarily, Mark would have been grossed out by that, but his mind was on other things right now.
"It's cool," said Mitchell. "What you do in the privacy of the can is your business. What's in the pack?"
Mark clutched the pack to his chest as if it contained precious papers, which, in fact, it did. His mind raced. What was the one thing he could say that Mitchell would accept and not ask more questions? The answer was clear.
"Playboys."
Mitchell gave a lascivious grin.
"Oh, you dog. Let me see."
He reached for the pack, but Mark yanked it away and backed toward the door.
"Sorry, I'm late."
Before Mitchell could say another word, Mark turned and ran from the room. He didn't know where he was going, but he ran anyway. The words from the pages kept running through his head. Could this story be true? This was the kind of stuff you saw in the movies or read in graphic novels. People made this stuff up for entertainment. It wasn't real. He probably would have dismissed the whole thing as a work of fiction except for the strange visitor he had the night before and the ring on his finger that made these pages appear on the bathroom floor. They were both real as can be. There was no logical explanation for what happened, so therefore all the normal rules of reality had to be tossed out the window. He needed to talk to Bobby. But if this story were true, Bobby was indisposed at the moment and not available for questioning. It was 9:30 in the morning. Mark and Bobby should have been in geometry class. Of course, Mark wasn't there because he was too busy running frantically through the empty halls of Stony Brook Junior High like a nut burger. Somehow geometry didn't seem all that important right now. But he swung by the classroom anyway, praying that he'd find Bobby sitting at his desk. Mark approached the door warily. He took a breath and looked in to see that Bobby's desk was empty. Not good. Mark didn't know where to turn. He had to talk to somebody, but who? He wanted to share what was going on, but more important, he needed confirmation that he wasn't totally out of his mind. That's when the answer came to him. There was one person who could verify part of the story. Courtney Chetwynd. The gym classes at Stony Brook were normally segregated, boys from girls. The only time the classes were co-ed was for gymnastics when they had to share the apparatus. The rest of the time there was a huge collapsible wall drawn between the boys' gym and the girls' gym. However, there was one other exception to the rule. That was Courtney Chetwynd. When it came to team sports, Courtney didn't play with the girls. She was tall and strong, and the advantage she had over most girls was unfair. So even though it went against every rule of the school system and the county and the state, Courtney was allowed to play with the guys. No one complained either. The girls were just as happy not to have to deal with her whooping up on them all the time. And after she proved herself to the guys, which took all of 30 seconds, they welcomed her. And they didn't cut her any slack either. In fact, most of the guys feared her. When Courtney played, it was full speed all the way around. And her game was volleyball. Wham! Courtney leaped high over the net and spiked the ball off the head of her poor opponent. The guy was stunned silly, and Courtney landed gracefully before the ball hit the ground.
"Point break,"
she said with a smile. Courtney never showed mercy. It was her serve now, and the ball was bounced to her.
Come on, Cece. Let's go. Game point.
Courtney had a killer serve, and everyone expected this to be the final nail in the coffin. But as she walked to the service line, something caught her eye. It was Mark Diamond. The little guy was waving at her frantically from outside the gym door. As soon as he got her attention, he started motioning for her to come over. Courtney raised a finger as if to say, "Wait one second," but that made Mark wave even harder. He would not be denied. Courtney frowned and tossed the ball to one of her teammates.
"You serve,"
she said, and headed toward Mark.
"What?"
the teammate yelled in shock.
"It's game point."
"I know. Don't blow it."
The guys watched her in wonder for a moment, then turned back to the game with a shrug. Though none of them would admit it, the guys from the other team breathed a little sigh of relief. Courtney headed straight for the door and threw it open to find Mark waiting in the empty hallway.
"This better be good,"
she said impatiently. Mark waffled back and forth nervously, shifting his weight from foot to foot. Courtney watched him for a second and then said,
"You have to pee."
"No, it's about Bobby."
Courtney's gray eyes focused.
"Where is he? Why didn't he play last night?"
Mark hesitated as if not wanting to ask the next question, but he did.
Did you guys make out at his house last night?"
Courtney stared at him, not exactly sure she heard what she thought she just heard. Then she blew a gasket.
"That's what you got me over here for? He missed the biggest game of the year and... Wait a minute. Did Bobby tell you about us? I'll kill him! Courtney, wait, it's not like that."
Mark tried to stop her angry tirade, but Courtney was on a roll.
"I don't care who he is. He can't go around telling private stuff that..."
"Stop!"
shouted Mark. Courtney did, mostly because she was so surprised Mark had made such a bold move. That wasn't like him. They both looked at each other, not sure of where to go next. Mark now had her attention, and it was up to him to make the next move. When he spoke, it was slow and thoughtful. He didn't want to stutter, and he didn't want to make a mistake. So he pushed his glasses back up on his nose and said,
"I think something strange happened to Bobby. What went on between you two last night was part of it. I'm sorry if it upsets you, but I've got to know. Did you two make out at his house last night?"
Courtney tried to read Mark. He was a shy guy, and the fact that he'd ask a personal question like this was hugely out of character. Clearly there was more going on here than guys bragging to each other about getting to first base with a girl. She could see it in his eyes. Mark was scared.
"Yeah,"
she said.
"We did. Where is he? I don't know,"
he said, downcast.
"I hope he's at his house. Will you come with me and talk to him?"
The two held eye contact for a long time. Courtney was trying to read Mark's thoughts, and Mark was praying that Courtney would come with him so he could share some of the burden of what he knew. Maybe she could even help him figure things out. Courtney walked past Mark and gave him a simple, quick, "Let's go." Courtney was now on a mission. She wanted to talk to Bobby. If she had to go to his house to find him, so be it. Mark was relieved that he now had an ally, but he had no idea how to tell Courtney what he knew, or if she'd believe him. For now, though, he was happy just to have someone to talk to. The Pendragons lived on a quiet cul-de-sac not far from school. It was lunchtime, so Courtney and Mark figured they could reach Bobby's house, get to the bottom of what was going on, and be back at school before anyone missed them. As they hurried up the sidewalk, Mark had to walk quickly to keep up with Courtney's long, purposeful strides. He wanted to tell her about the visitor he had had the night before, and the ring, and the parchment with Bobby's story, but he was afraid she'd dismiss him as a mental case. He had to choose his words carefully.
"Do you know Bobby's Uncle Press?"
he asked cautiously.
"Yeah." "Did
Did you see him last night?
Unfortunately, he's the guy who caught us making out.
Mark's heart sank. Not that it mattered if Bobby and Courtney made out or that they were caught by Bobby's uncle. The problem was, Courtney's answer confirmed more of the story contained on the parchment papers. Mark feared that if some of the story were true, then maybe all of it was true. The thought made him sick. They were nearly at Bobby's house now. Mark hoped that Bobby would be there to settle everything. He imagined walking up to Bobby, holding out the parchment paper, and seeing Bobby bust out laughing. Bobby would say it was all a goof and that he never expected them to think it was real. It was a prank, like Orson Welles' War of the Worlds radio broadcast that made everybody think the Earth was being invaded by Martians. That's what Mark was hoping for. But what they both saw in the next instant dashed that hope entirely. To Linden Place. That was the address. Mark had been there 1,000 times. Ever since kindergarten, they'd trade off playing at each other's house. Bobby's house was like his second home. Mrs. Pendragon called Mark her second son. That's why nothing could prepare him for what he was about to see. Courtney and Mark walked up the sidewalk that led to the split-rail fence that surrounded Bobby's front yard and stopped cold. They both looked at 2 Linden Place, stunned.
"Oh, my God,"
was all Courtney could whisper. Mark couldn't even get that much out. 2 Linden Place was gone. The two of them stood together, wide-eyed, looking at a vacant lot. There were no signs that a house had ever been there, not a single piece of wood, brick, stone, or blade of grass existed in the space. The ground was nothing but dirt. Mark looked to the huge maple tree where years before Mr. Pendragon had hung a tire swing for the boys. The tree was there, but there was no swing. Even the branch that had been rope-scarred by years of swinging was clean. No marks, nothing. Courtney broke first.
"It's the wrong address."
Mark said softly.
"It's not the wrong address."
Courtney wouldn't accept it. She stormed onto the empty lot.
"But I was here last night. There was a sidewalk to the house right here, and the front door was here, and Bobby and I were standing."
Her voice trailed off. She looked to Mark with dread.
"Mark, what happened?"
Now was as good a time as any. Even though he had no idea what had happened, seeing the empty lot confirmed his worst fears. Everything he had read on the pages from Bobby was true. He had more questions than he had answers, but he did have some answers, as strange as they were. He wanted to share them with Courtney. Knowing all this by himself was too tough. So he reached for his backpack and took out the yellow parchment papers.
"I want you to read something," he said. "It's from Bobby."
He held out the pages to Courtney, who looked at them, then back to Mark. Reluctantly, she took the pages from him and sat down. Right there. Right in the middle of the empty lot at 2 Linden Place, not far from the spot where she and Bobby shared their first kiss. She looked down at the pages and started to read. Journal Number 1. Continued. Denduron.
"I thought my life was over. All that was left was to wait for the pain. Would it come fast and hit me hard, or would it start at my feet and gradually work its way up my legs, over my body, and zero in right on my head in a brilliant, searing flash of agony before everything went dark? I was voting for fast, but it didn't come fast. In fact, it didn't come at all. There was no pain. I didn't die. Instead, I found myself falling through this snaking tunnel. It was like sailing down one of those water park rides, but the water park rides are actually more violent than this. Now that it's over, I can look back on it and actually say it was kind of fun. But that's now. At the time, I was freaking out. Once I realized I wasn't being sucked into some giant garbage disposal, I opened my eyes and looked around. It felt like I was moving fast. Like I wrote before, the walls of the tunnel were craggy, like rocks, but they were translucent, too, as if they were crystal. The strange thing was, it wasn't a bumpy ride. I was flying along, feet first like on a playground slide, but it felt like I was floating. I couldn't feel the walls of the tunnel. There were many twists and turns, but I didn't get slammed against the walls or anything like you do when you hit the turns on a water slide. It felt like I was floating on a magic carpet that knew exactly where it was taking me. There were sounds, too. They were soft notes, like from a tuning fork. All different notes. Pretty notes. They were the same kind of notes I heard when the tunnel came to life, but much further apart. That's one of the reasons I could tell I was going so fast, because I was sailing past the notes. The sound would come up fast from up ahead, and then flash past me and disappear behind. It was a strange sensation. I looked back the way I came, and there was nothing but crystal tunnel for as far as I could see. I looked down between my feet, and it was the same thing. Snaking tunnel. Infinity. After a while, I got used to it. Sort of. There was nothing I could do to stop anyway, so I figured why fight it? Now, here's the freaky thing. As if everything up to this point wasn't freaky enough. I could look out beyond the crystal walls to see that it was dark out there. I figured that made sense. I was underground, after all. But when I looked harder, it seemed as if the blackness was broken up by thousands and thousands of stars. I know. Screwy, right? I had started in an underground subway and was going deeper underground from there, so how could I be looking at stars? But that's what it looked like. Why should this make any more sense than anything else? I don't know how long I was flying. 3 minutes? 3 months? My normal sense of relativity had long since gone bye-bye. I'd given myself over to the experience, and wherever it took me, and for how long, it just didn't matter. And then I heard something different. It wasn't one of the soft notes that had been my guides on this bizarro journey. This sounded, well, solid. It sounded craggy. It sounded like I was coming to the end of the line. I looked down between my feet and saw it. The end. The twisting, bright tunnel ended in darkness, and I was headed for it. Fast. All around me, the walls of the tunnel started to change. They were transforming from the translucent crystal back to the slate-gray, craggy rocks that I had seen at their start near the subway. The panic returned. Was I about to hit the center of the Earth? Wasn't there supposed to be a core of molten magma there? Was this magical flight just a prelude to a fiery death? Whatever was going to happen, it was going to happen now. So I did the one and only thing I could think of to prepare myself for the end. I closed my eyes. But the end wasn't a fiery crash at all. I got the same tingling feeling that I had felt at the mouth of the tunnel. Then there was a shower of sound. All the sweet notes I had been hearing gathered together the way they did at the beginning of my journey. I felt as if a heavy weight were pressing against my chest. The next thing I knew, I was standing up. The musical notes faded away. I had been gently deposited somewhere by the magic carpet. It was strange having to support my own weight after having been weightless for the journey. I was like an astronaut returning from space who needed to get used to gravity again. I opened my eyes, looked back, and saw the tunnel. It looked exactly like the mouth I had entered back at the subway. It was gray and dark and stretched out to nowhere. I had arrived safely. But where was I? Another subway station? In China, maybe? I turned around to know where the tunnel had deposited me and saw that I was at the entrance to some sort of cave. Now that I had my wits back, I realized that I was cold. The sharp sound I had heard during the last stretch of my journey was a howling wind. Wherever I was, I wasn't underground anymore. I took a few shaky steps away from the mouth of the tunnel and entered the cave. As I walked into this larger space, I noticed that the cave was marked by the same star symbol that was on the door in the subway. It was carved into the rock at about eye level. Weird. I then saw light pouring in from an opening on the far side of the cavern. It was so bright that it made the rest of the cave seem pitch black. I was suddenly overcome by the feeling that I had been in the dark way too long. I wanted out, and that light showed me the way, so I stumbled along to reach it. When I got there, I knew that it was indeed the way out of the cave. The light also told me that it was daytime. How long had I been in that tunnel? All night? Or was it daytime in China? My eyes weren't accustomed to the light, so I had to cover them and squint. I stepped outside and immediately realized it was even colder out here. All I had on was my Stony Brook warm-up top over a T-shirt, so the wind cut through me instantly. Man, it was freezing. I took a few steps and looked down to see snow. The ground was covered with snow. That's another reason it was so bright. The sun reflected off the snow and blinded me. I knew it wouldn't take long for my eyes to adjust, so rather than duck back into the cave to get warm, I waited till I could see. I wanted to know where I was. After a few seconds, I gingerly took my hands away from my eyes. My pupils had finally contracted enough to let me see, and what was there waiting for me nearly knocked me off my feet. I was standing on top of a mountain. And this was no small ski mountain like we go to in Vermont. This was like Everest. Okay, maybe not that big, but I felt like I was on top of the world. Craggy snowfields stretched for as far as I could see. In the far distance, way down below, I could see that the snow gave way to a green, lush valley. But it was a long, steep trip between here and there. One question kept running through my head. Where in heck am I? Good question, but I had no one to ask. So I turned to go back into the safety of the cave to get my act together and figure out some kind of plan. Just before I turned back, I saw, scattered several yards away from the mouth of the cave, these yellowish, kind of smooth, pointed rocks about 2 feet high. They jutted up out of the snow like stalagmites, or stalactites, I can never remember which is which. They stuck up and came to a sharp point. I had no idea what they could be, but the word tombstones kept creeping into my head. I shook that particularly morbid thought out of my brain and trudged through the snow back to the cave. That's when I saw the strangest thing of all. The sun was just rising up over the rocks that formed the cave. But I had just been shielding my eyes against the sun that was shining from the other direction. How could that be? I looked behind me to see that there wasn't just one sun. There were three. I swear, Mark, there were three suns in opposite corners of the sky. I blinked, thinking my vision was just screwed up or something, but it didn't help. They were still there. My mind locked up. I didn't know what to think, but there was one thing I knew for sure. I wasn't in China. I stood there on top of this mountain all alone, sneakers getting wet in the snow, staring up at three blazing suns. I'm not ashamed to admit this. I wanted my mom. I wanted to be sitting in front of the TV fighting for the remote with Shannon. I wanted to be washing the car with Dad. I wanted to be shooting hoops with you. Suddenly the things I had taken for granted in life felt very far away. I wanted to go home, but all I could do was stand there and cry. I really did. I cried. Then the sound came again, from inside the cave, the same jumble of musical notes that had sucked me into the tunnel and dumped me here. Someone else was coming. Uncle Press. It had to be.
I ran back into the cave, overjoyed that I wasn't going to be alone anymore. But then another thought hit me. What if it wasn't Uncle Press? What if it was that St. Dane guy? The last time I had the pleasure of hanging with that dude, he was shooting at us. And I gotta tell you, getting shot at isn't like what you see in the movies or with Nintendo. It's real and it's terrifying. I could still feel the sting on the back of my neck where I got hit by the shattered pieces of tile. I didn't know what to do, so I stopped in the middle of the big cave and waited. Whoever it was would be coming out of the tunnel. Would it be Uncle Press or St. Dane? Or maybe those freaking dogs that wanted to eat me? Wouldn't that be just perfect? Who was it going to be, friend or foe?
Bobby?
It was Uncle Press. He walked out of the tunnel with his long leather coat flapping against his legs. I could have hugged him. In fact, I did. I ran over to him like a little kid. If this were a movie, I'd have been running in slow motion. I threw my arms around him with the feeling of pure joy and gratitude that I wasn't alone anymore, and that my favorite guy in the world wasn't shot dead by that St. Dane guy. He was safe. This feeling lasted for about, 3 seconds. Now that my fear of impending doom was gone, reality came flooding back, and there was only one person responsible for my being here, Uncle Press. Someone I trusted. Someone I loved. Someone who yanked me from home and nearly got me killed about 8 times over. I pushed away from him with a shove that was hard enough to knock him off his feet, because that's what I wanted to do. I wanted him to feel how angry I was. But as I saw before, Uncle Press was strong. It was like trying to push over a wall. All I managed to do was knock myself off balance and fall on my butt. "What the hell is going on?" I shouted as I scrambled back to my feet, trying not to look like an idiot.
"Bobby, I know you're confused about—"
"Confused? Confused doesn't begin to cover it!" I stormed over to the mouth of the tunnel and screamed, "Dendron! Dendron!" I'd say anything to get out of there, but nothing happened.
"This is Dendron. We're already here," he said, as if that were supposed to make sense.
"Okay, then." I looked into the tunnel and screamed, "Earth! New York! The subway! There's no place like home!" I ran into the tunnel, hoping the magical notes would pick me up and fly me home. But nothing happened. I came back out and got right in Uncle Press's face. "I don't care what this is about," I said with as much authority as I could generate. "I don't even care where we are. I care about going home and going home now. Take me home." Uncle Press just looked at me. He had to know how angry and scared I was, so I think he was trying to choose his next words carefully. Unfortunately, no matter how carefully he chose his next words, there was no good way of saying what he then told me.
"Bobby, you can't go home. You belong here right now."
Boom! Just like that. I backed away from him, stunned. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to think. I wanted to cry. I wanted to hit him. I wanted to reason with him. I wanted to wake up and find this was all just a horrible nightmare. Uncle Press didn't say anything. He just watched me and waited for me to get my act together. But with all the confusing information that had been so rudely input into my poor little skull, all I could squeak out was a single, simple question. "Why?"
"I told you. There are people here on Dendron who need our help," he said slowly, as if to a little kid, which made me even more angry.
"But I don't know these people!" I shouted. "I don't care about them. I care about me. I care about getting me home. What is it about that you don't understand?"
"I understand perfectly, but that can't happen," he said firmly.
"Why? What's so important about these people? And where is here anyway? Where is this Dendron?"
"That's hard to explain."
"Try," I said. I was getting fed up with all the mystery. Uncle Press sat down on a rock. I took that as a sign that he was ready to start helping me understand things.
We are far from Earth, but this isn't a different planet in the sense you're thinking. It's a territory, like Earth is a territory.
Territory, planet? What's the difference? It's just words.
No, it's not. If we had a spaceship and blasted off from here and went to the place where Earth is, it wouldn't be there. At least, not the way you know it. When you travel through the flumes...
Flumes? I repeated.
That's how you got here, through a flume. When you travel to the territories through flumes, you're not just going from place to place. You're moving through space and time. I know that's hard to comprehend, but you'll get it.
I was not so sure I wanted to get it. Maybe it was better to stay ignorant. I looked at Uncle Press, and for the first time it hit me that this guy wasn't the person I thought he was. I always knew he was a mysterious character, but now he was way more Ozone-esque than I could ever have imagined.
"Who are you?" I asked. "Really, you're not a normal guy."
Uncle Press smiled and looked down. Somehow I had the feeling that this wasn't going to be an easy answer either.
"I'm your uncle, Bobby. But I'm also a traveler, just like you are."
Another new word, traveler. I didn't want to be a traveler. I wanted to be Bobby Pendragon, point guard on the Stony Brook basketball team. But that life seemed pretty far away right now.
"So, if we're not on Earth, why is it like Earth? I mean, I can breathe, and there's snow and normal gravity and all."
He answered,
"All the territories are pretty much like Earth, but not exactly."
"You mean like the three suns here?"
"Good example."
"And those weird yellow stone things sticking up out of the snow?"
Suddenly Uncle Press got tense.
"Where? Outside? How many are there?"
"I don't know. 10, 12.
Uncle Press shot to his feet and started pulling off his coat.
"We gotta go."
He dumped his coat on the ground and hurried to the far side of the cave, where there was a pile of dried branches. He started pulling at them.
"Well, what's the matter?"
I said, confused and more than a little worried. He turned to me and raised a finger to his lips to shush me. He continued pulling branches off the pile and spoke quietly, as if not wanting to be heard.
"Quigs,"
he said.
Uh-oh. Quigs. Not a new word. I hated that word.
"Those aren't quigs. Quigs are like dogs, right?" I asked, hopefully.
"Depends on the territory," he whispered. "On second Earth, they're like dogs, not here."
"So what are quigs?" I asked. But I wasn't really sure I wanted to know.
"They're wild animals that are special to each territory,"
he explained.
"St. Dane uses them to keep the travelers away from the flumes."
There was that name again, St. Dane. Somehow I knew he'd factor back into this equation. But how was it possible for a guy to use a wild animal to do anything?
Before I got the chance to ask, Uncle Press pulled off the last branches to reveal a jumble of fur and leather.
Animal pelts.
He then started taking off his shirt.
"We can't wear second Earth clothes in this territory. Put these on,"
he said as he lifted up a nasty-looking piece of skin.
"You gotta be kidding,"
was all I could say.
"Don't argue with me, Bobby. These will keep you warm."
"But no buts. Hurry."
He said this in a stage whisper. He really was afraid of the quigs. I figured I should be too, so I started taking off my clothes.
"Even my underwear?" I asked,
horrified at what the answer would be.
"They don't wear boxers on Denderon,"
he said, which is exactly what I didn't want to hear. This was going to be uncomfortable. I followed Uncle Press's instructions and dressed in the leather and fur. There were even leather boots that were kind of soft, which was good because they didn't wear gold-toe sweat socks on Denderon either. As we took more of the clothing off the pile, something else was slowly revealed. I picked up one last furry pelt and saw a two-man sled. It looked sort of like the sled you see in Alaska for sled dogs, but there was nothing modern about this thing. The runners were slats of wood, the sides were made of branches,
The seats were woven out of some kind of cane, and the steering mechanism up front was fashioned out of huge antlers. Fred Flintstone would have been proud. But there was something else about this sled that made me nervous. Lashed to either side were long, deadly-looking spears. The shafts were carved from smooth tree branches. The tips were made of hammered-out metal and looked surgical sharp. The tails had some sort of feathers attached for stability. As crude and low-tech as the whole rig was, these bad boys looked pretty lethal. They hung on either side of the sled like prehistoric sidewinder missiles, ready for launching.
"What about your gun?"
I asked hopefully. "Can't we use that on the Quigs?"
"There are no guns in this territory,"
he answered, then stopped working for a moment and looked me dead in the eye.
"We can only use what the territory offers. That's important. Remember that, okay?"
"Yeah, sure, whatever."
He then shoved something into my hand. It was a small, carved object that hung from a leather cord.
"It looked like it's a whistle," he said,
reading my thoughts.
"Keep it handy."
I wanted to ask why, but at this point it didn't really matter. I just hoped Uncle Press was as good with a spear as he was with a gun, because a little whistle sure as heck wasn't going to protect us if things got hairy. I followed orders and put it around my neck.
"You ready?"
he asked. "No," was my usual reply. Though, honestly, I was. I felt a little like a caveman, but the strange clothes fit me fine. Where they were too big, I tied them tight with leather straps, the way Uncle Press showed me. I was actually pretty comfortable. The only bad thing was I really wished I could have kept my underwear. There was going to be some major league rash action going on here, and they probably didn't have talcum powder on Dendron either. Uncle Press started dragging the sled toward the light and the entrance of the cave. I helped him pull.
"When we get the sled in the snow, hop on and sit in back," he instructed. "I'll get us going and steer from the front. If we're lucky, we'll be gone before the Quigs wake up."
"What if we're not lucky?"
was the obvious next question.
"We can't outrun them. Our only hope is to get one of them."
"Get? Define get."
He didn't. We were at the mouth of the cave. Uncle Press looked at me.
"I'm sorry for this, Bobby. I really am. All I can say is that sometime soon you'll understand why it had to be this way."
He said this with such conviction that I actually believed him. The thing was, I was afraid to believe him. Because if what he had been saying was true, I'd have no choice but to face whatever trouble lay ahead. And based on what had happened so far, it wasn't going to be fun.
"I hope you know how to drive this thing," I said.
"Hold on tight,"
was his answer.
Yeah, right. Like I planned on waving my hands in the air like on a roller coaster.
"Give me a break."
We pulled the sled out of the cave and onto the snow. It took a few seconds for my eyes to adjust to the light again, but when I did, the first thing I saw were the ominous-looking yellow-pointed rocks sticking up out of the snow. In spite of Uncle Press's fear, I didn't see how these things could be dangerous. Uncle Press motioned silently for me to get in. He then went to the back and started pushing. For a clunky prehistoric bobsled, it moved pretty smoothly. In front of us was the field of yellow stones. I counted 12 of them, spread out over several yards. We glided closer to them with almost no sound. I looked to Uncle Press. He winked at me and put a finger to his lips as a reminder to be quiet. After a few more yards, we were right in the middle of them. Uncle Press maneuvered the sled carefully so as not to disturb anything. That's when we started to pick up speed. The slope was growing steeper. I looked ahead, and suddenly I wasn't worried about the Quigs anymore. We were about to set sail down a steep, craggy, boulder-strewn, snow-covered mountain on a rickety piece of wood that was held together by leather straps. Compared to that, how horrible could some 2-foot-tall animals be? I was about to find out. We were nearly out of the field of yellow stones when right in front of us, the snow started to shake. There was only one stone left, but one was enough. Suddenly, right in front of us, the snow cracked, and the yellow pointed stone started to rise up. But it wasn't a pointed stone at all. This was a spike made of bone that stuck out of the back of the most hideous beast I had ever seen. The quig rose up out of the snow until its entire body was free. It looked like a huge, dirty gray grizzly bear. But its head was giant, with fangs like a wild boar, upper and lower, spiky sharp. Its paws were oversized, too, with claws the size of piano keys, sharp piano keys. And its eyes looked like the eyes of the dogs in the subway. They were yellow and angry and focused on us. Uncle Press maneuvered the sled around the quig and ran while he pushed, trying to get more speed.
"Get the spear!"
he shouted. I couldn't take my eyes off the beast. It reared up on its hind legs and let out a horrifying bellow that I thought would wake the dead, or at least wake the other quigs. And that's exactly what happened. Behind us, the snow around the other yellow spikes started to boil. The rest of the quigs were waking up.
"Bobby, move!"
Uncle Press jumped onto the sled, and I snapped to my senses. I dove forward to grab one of the spears. We were moving faster now, bouncing over the snow. It was tough to keep my balance. I stayed low and leaned over the side to try and untie one of the two spears.
"Hurry, please,"
came from the back. He was calm, but insistent. I turned to look and saw that there were now a dozen quigs behind us, shaking off the snow. I shouldn't have looked. The trouble was I had almost finished untying the spear, and just as I looked back, the sled hit a bump. Before I realized what was happening, the spear worked itself loose and fell off. I tried to grab it, but it was too late. It clattered to the snow, just out of my reach. Gone.
"The other one, now!"
shouted Uncle Press. I dove across the sled to get the other spear. I grabbed it and held it tight with one hand while fumbling to untie it with the other. There was no way I was going to let this one get away. Finally, I worked off the strap and the spear was loose. "Got it!" I shouted. I fell back, holding it up for Uncle Press to grab. Once he had it, I got to my knees and looked behind us. To my horror, I saw that the quigs were now charging. It was like a stampede of snarling, vicious bears that had us in their sights. I had no idea what one little spear could do against this deadly onslaught.
"Steer!"
shouted Uncle Press.
"Keep it steady!"
I scrambled to the front of the sled and grabbed hold of the antlers. The sled responded perfectly. Whoever built this thing knew what they were doing. Still, Uncle Press was right. We weren't going fast enough to lose the quigs. They were getting closer. The first quig was far ahead of the others, and it was getting dangerously close. I kept glancing back over my shoulder to see what was happening. Uncle Press was amazing. He stood on the sled, backward, with spear in hand. I was getting used to seeing Uncle Press pull off stunts like this. Nothing surprised me anymore. Like Captain Ahab hunting Moby Dick, Uncle Press waited for the quig.
"Come on, come on, little closer,"
he growled, taunting it. The quig obliged. It was nearly on us. It charged forward with a bloodlust, ready to snap its jaws shut on Uncle Press.
"The whistle!"
Uncle Press shouted back.
"Blow it, now!"
The whistle? What was a whistle going to do? But I wasn't about to argue. While keeping one hand on the steering antlers, I fumbled for the carved whistle around my neck. The beast was almost on Uncle Press. I finally managed to grab hold of the whistle, pulled the leather cord over my head, put it to my lips, and blew. It didn't sound like anything. The thing must have been designed like one of those silent dog whistles where the sound was so high-pitched that only dogs could hear it. Well, only dogs and quigs. And quigs didn't like it. The beast suddenly opened its hideous mouth and let out another bellow that made the hair on the back of my neck stand out.
It was a roar of pain, as if the high-pitched sound from the whistle was piercing its head. That's when Uncle Press struck. He hurled the spear like an Olympic javelin thrower. The deadly missile flew straight at the quig and stabbed into its open mouth. The beast let out a choked howl as the spear plunged into the back of its throat. It stopped short, kicking up a spray of snow as it fell to its side. Blood spewed from its open mouth like a gruesome fountain. It was disgusting. But not as disgusting as what happened next. The other quigs caught up with the first one, and rather than come after us, they all stopped and pounced on their fallen brother. It was a frenzy feed, like you see with sharks when there's blood in the water. I can still hear the sound they made as they tore into it, ripping it apart. The sound of flesh being torn away from cracking bones is not one I care to hear again. It was still alive, too. Its pained screams were horrifying. Thankfully, they didn't last long. I took one last look back and wished I hadn't. At that moment, one of the quigs looked up at us, and I saw that its mouth and fangs were smeared with the blood of its living meal. Now I knew what Uncle Press meant by getting one of the quigs.
"Look out!"
he shouted. I quickly looked ahead and saw we were seconds away from slamming into a boulder the size of a car. I turned the antlers hard. The sled turned, but the back fishtailed into a skid that slammed us into the boulder. We kept moving, though the shock was so strong it threw Uncle Press to the floor of the sled. It nearly knocked me off, too, but I grabbed the antlers in a death grip. It would take a heck of a lot more than a little bumping around to pry me loose. The only problem was, when I grabbed the antlers, I dropped the quig whistle. If the quigs came after us again, we'd be in deep trouble. We had no spears and no whistle. Why hadn't I left the strap around my neck? Now we were going fast. The slope turned double diamond steep. I could see that we were about to reach the tree line. Up to this point, we only had to maneuver across snow and avoid some boulders. Now we were headed into a forest.
"I got it!"
shouted Uncle Press. He had made his way to the front of the sled, and I was only too happy to let him take charge.
"I don't suppose we've got brakes," I shouted.
"I wish,"
came the shouted answer. Bad answer. This wasn't a nicely groomed ski slope. Oh, no. We were headed full tilt boogie into the trees. The only thing that was going to stop us now was something solid. I didn't want to find anything solid. That would hurt.
"Right! Lean right!"
shouted Uncle Press. I did, and he skirted us around a tree.
"Stay with me. Watch where we're going. Left!"
he shouted. It was like riding on the back of his motorcycle. We both had to lean into the turns to help make them. But the motorcycle had brakes, and we didn't have to drive it through a minefield of trees. This was terrifying. We were rocketing down on a rickety bobsled through a slalom course of rock-solid pine trees. We flew past trunks with inches to spare. Left, right, right again. We were going too fast for Uncle Press to tell me which way to lean. I had to look ahead and anticipate what turns he was going to make. Branches slashed at our faces. We were so close to some trees I could hear them as we sailed past. The further down we dropped, the more dense the forest became.
"There's a clearing ahead,"
he shouted.
"When we hit it, I'm going to turn sharp right. Hopefully we won't flip."
Yeah, hopefully. And hopefully we won't launch ourselves into a rolling tumble that'll land us into a tree. Not that I had a better idea.
"When I make the turn, lean hard right,"
he yelled.
"We're almost there."
I looked ahead and saw it. Through the trees, there was a field of white. That must be the clearing. But we still had a lot of trees between here and there, and we were still moving fast. Left, left, right. A few more turns, and we'd hit the clearing.
"We're gonna make it!"
I shouted. We didn't. Our left runner hit a snow-covered root that kicked us up on our right side, but we kept going. Now we were on one runner and out of control. There were only a few trees between us and the safety of the clearing when we crashed.
The sled hit a tree and spun us around. The force of the collision was huge. I mean, it rocked me. But I stayed with the sled. Uncle Press wasn't so lucky. He was ejected. And I kept going. The sled fell down off the right runner and now ran flat again. But I was lying in the back, miles from the controls. I was nearly at the clearing, and for an instant, I thought I'd make it. But then the sled hit a rise, and suddenly I was airborne. If there was